Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And joining us on the roundtable this week is Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Laura.
Good morning.
And Joe Ingles, reporter at Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be here.
And joining us in a few minutes will be Jake Zuckerman, the newest reporter at Signal Ohio. This past Friday, there was news that the Trump administration will be backing off on terminating the legal status of international students. The move comes after many, including two Ohio State students, filed court challenges. The reversal could potentially affect more than 60 international students at 15 Ohio colleges who had their legal status revoked. Joe, what do we know about why the administration took this step? Do we know if there are any more about what it means for international students in particular in Ohio? It got a little confusing on Friday.
Yeah, it did get a little confusing. And to be quite honest, I'm a little confused about, you know, the specifics about why they were targeted to begin with. But the courts are looking at this and starting to look at this and say, you know, there wasn't due process. That's something that's an issue here. And then, you know, Trump backed off of it. But there's still questions about, you know, whether these students should be here and what status, and statuses are being revoked for different, you know, different reasons. So it's all very murky right now. But it does appear that for right now, some of the students who were initially had their visas revoked, those students will have their visas from right now.
Yeah. Laura, have you been following all of this? It kind of changed back and forth a couple of times on Friday.
Yeah, I think it's it is very flexible. It keeps going back and forth. And I don't think we've heard the last of this story. What I think is interesting is that in the polls, Donald Trump's approval rating on immigration was really high when he first was elected. Mm-hmm. And now it's below 50%. He's underwater on that. And I think it's in part because it's not just you know, violent criminals that they're trying to deport and move out, but that it's even, you know, PhD students in engineering who had some sort of minor transgression in traffic court or spoke out at a campus protest or whatever. And I think that pushing the envelope on that side of the immigration issues, that has caused the American public to kind of say, like, well, hang on a second, that's not what we bargained for. It's not what we voted for.
I want to welcome to the studio Jake Zuckerman, the newest reporter at Signal Ohio. Welcome back, Jake.
Welcome. Thank you for having me on. Sorry I'm a little late.
Yeah, that's okay. You are the more the merrier. I want to transition to a few pieces of audio that we have that all happened on Friday. Well, it happened before everything that happened on Friday. In related news, a federal judge ordered the Trump administration to reinstate an OSU graduate student, a teaching assistant, Awar Sultan, from India. Sultan was arrested last April and charged with criminal trespassing as a part of the pro-Palestinian protests that were on campus last year. The charges were later dismissed and expunged in a Franklin County court. So in the midst of all the visa issues in the news, and this again was before Trump made his latest action, but Governor DeWine was asked specifically about this issue, and here's what he had to say.
We have international students. They contribute to the culture. They contribute to other students understanding what goes on in different places in the world, wherever they're from. The other side of that is, with a state university, you know, they very well may be taking the place of an Ohio student.
Now, DeWine's comments about international students taking the place of an Ohio student, related to that, NBC4 reporter Natalie Fahmy asked for a response from Awar Sultan's attorney, Jenna Al Akaras. Let's hear that.
The governor of this state says that he thinks international students have a place on Ohio campuses, but he says on the other side, they might be taking the spot of Ohioans to go to these schools. What's your reaction to a comment like that?
I'm not sure who you're asking, but I can tell you that that's ludicrous. There is plenty of space on our campuses for both residents of Ohio. We make no such arguments when it comes to bringing people from outside of the state to Ohio State University. And that is, you know, the history of having international students on our campus is a long one. And I think now is not the time to be othering our students.
Now, WSU's reporter George Shilcock then spoke again to Sultan's attorney later on Friday after Trump's reversal of the decision, and she said that her client remains fearful. And that is similar to what he said in a press conference earlier that day. This is how he was feeling before Trump made his reversal.
I now fear abduction and subsequent deportation by ICE. It is true that I risk deportation even as I stand here in front of you, and partly because I stand here in front of you. The risk is still there, even though my case is in court.
Now, just to our roundtable, I mean, that's a lot of back and forth. You know, you have Governor DeWine saying that international students are important, but then also saying international students might take a spot from an Ohio student. And then you have, you have what the attorney said, and then you have this student who's worried about speaking out and even talking in public and getting deported. What do you make of all this back and forth, Joe?
There's an uncertainty, and I would say that it goes beyond immigration. I think the Trump administration, there's been a lot of uncertainty about a lot of different things, but we're seeing this in this case in immigration because, you know, it seems like there's no consistency of thought or, you know, action. One thing will happen one day, and the next day it changes and it's something else happens. So if you're a student who's here on a visa and you're worried about being able to stay, you know, I can see where they could see some uncertainty and be nervous about it.
Yeah. And Laura, what do you make of Governor DeWine's comments where he kind of said both things, like, yes, we like international students, but they also could be taking the spot of an Ohio student?
I think that line about, international or even out of state students taking spots at Ohio State, that's been used for decades. I mean, I've heard that for a long time. There's kind of a pushback. I will say that, you know, a lot of these international students come for advanced degrees and they stay. A lot of them stay and they start their own businesses or they take really good jobs and really kind of get woven into the fabric of Ohio and are big contributors. And they also pay full freight on tuition. So
there's
university,
that.
Public universities often encourage international students. I think that longer term, though, I think the fallout is going to be is that if you're, a hotshot engineering student who wants to go get a PhD in some, you know, really niche area, you might not consider universities in the United States anymore. You might look to somewhere in Europe or elsewhere, just because of that uncertainty that Joe said.
Jake, have you been covering this issue at all?
Yeah.
In your job transition?
I have. Something I'd add here is that this apparent scarcity of students, this has never really come up before. You know, the student university leaders are before the legislature all the time asking for money. They've never said, we're running out of space, we have more students than we can fit, and the foreign students are crowding out the domestic ones. It's never really come up before, so I think you have to look at it with some scrutiny when this new apparent scarcity arises out of this deportation push.
Well, I guess it remains to be seen because there's a lot of changes that are happening. Things changed three times just on Friday afternoon alone. So you're listening to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable on All Sides, and we're talking politics with Laura Bischoff from the Columbus Dispatch, Jake Zuckerman, a reporter with Signal Ohio. Sorry, Jake, I'm getting used to that. And then Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Okay, so speaking of higher education, I want to touch on the latest developments and efforts to change a controversial new law that takes effect in June. So some professors from Youngstown State University have started collecting petition signatures, and they want to start the process of repealing Senate Bill 1. Now, this might be a real uphill battle to get it on the ballot. Joe, what do we know about getting this repeal of Senate Bill 1 possibly on the ballot?
Well, there's three professors at Youngstown State who started circulating this petition, and they did find support from other professors, from other people who were sympathetic, and they were able to get the 1,000 valid signatures they needed to get that first step of the petition process. So right now, the petition's being looked at. It's being they have a few more days, and then they tell them, you know, you can take action on, you know, where you go with it, and then they have to get more petition signatures. And the thing is that it's a long process to get to the ballot involving a lot of petition signatures, and the initial you know, right now, the unions, the big unions who can provide a lot of people to go out and get those petition signatures, they are not, they're not opposing the effort, but they're just, they're saying, hey, we're not, this is where, not where we want to focus our efforts. We want to focus our efforts on the legal side of it. We want to do something different with it. We don't want to focus on the, you know, the ballot measure, because here's the thing, it's hard in Ohio to pass a ballot, a repeal on the ballot. That's a very hard thing to do, and it costs a lot of money. And, you know, the question is that money better spent on other things?
Yeah. The last time a ballot measure was repealed, is that the anti-union one? Is
yeah,
that,
I think is, so. Okay. Senate Bill 5. And yeah. That was back in, what, 2011? Am I right about that? Or 2000?
Yeah, it was like the first or second year of, I think it was the first year of the John Kasich administration.
Yeah.
And, you know, the last time they tried to put a bill up for a referendum was House Bill 6.
Mm.
Back in 2019.
And that missed the ballot, right?
It missed the ballot in part because there was like a, you know, there's tens of millions of dollars in a counter campaign to confuse the issue and, you know, spy on the other side. And
yeah, there's, you know, lots of money there.
Yeah.
So Joe, basically what you're saying is the Ohio Education Association wants to pursue a different route that's a legal one. So
yeah.
They want to get maybe even just parts of Senate Bill 1 repealed by suing over,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, because there are questions about whether parts of Senate Bill 1 are constitutional. And so I think, you know, they're weighing their options, and they've kind of seen more opportunity for success on that side of it. And, you know, like I said, a lot of manpower, a lot of time and money spent on the other side. And we did see last year when the redistricting issue went to the ballot, if you remember back, how much that took as far as money and time and being able to spin messages, and, you know, it's a lot. Mm-hmm. So,
well, the other thing is there's a clock running. After a bill takes effect, you get 90 days to collect all the signatures and take it to the ballot.
Hmm.
Yeah, one thing I'd add, though, is colleges are kind of well-positioned here. I think they could avoid some of the costs. You know, if you're trying to repeal your House Bill 6, you need to distribute people. You need a certain amount of signatures from 44 of 88 counties. The colleges have people distributed. You know, they have student bodies and faculties distributed all around the state. So you could see how they circumvent some of these. So I think it's just like an interesting choice to take the legal approach and the political one. I mean, when you look at the courts in Ohio versus what they might be able to accomplish politically.
Well, and lawmakers are heading back into session after a 2-week recess. Do you think the state leaders just feel like their higher education bill will just go into effect? They're not really worried about this. Do you think that they're going to just move on? Have you heard anything from any of them about this repeal effort?
I'm not going to say they're not worried about it, but I think that they think it's going to go into effect, and they think that the ball is in their court right now for sure.
I think one of the big shifts is that bill gave a lot of funding discretion to the legislature. So if you act out, you could be punished. And I'm sure that has to be weighing on the minds of any board of trustees right now.
And Jake, another college related issue, while we're just spending all this time talking about higher education, nearly 200 presidents in colleges and universities signed a letter last week objecting to the, quote, unprecedented government overreach and political interference from the Trump administration. Now, notably, Ohio's largest university, Ohio State, did not sign, but some smaller college presidents did. You were covering this issue about who signed and who didn't, right? Can you talk a little bit more about what this means to have 200 presidents of colleges and universities sign a letter?
Yeah, and well, to add some more detail here, I mean, it's, if you look at the list of signatories, it is mostly, but not exclusively, small schools. But I saw, let's see, University of Wisconsin, University of Michigan. You know, there were some big state University of Virginia, I think, the Ivies. So there were some big schools that really stuck their necks out and signed onto that letter. And in Ohio, you know, Kenyon College, Denison College, Oberlin College, Ohio Wesleyan signed it. But Ohio State, Ohio University, Kent State, University of Cincinnati, you know, these big schools, the real muscle, the political muscle here was nowhere to be found, which, I mean, you can understand why a college might not want, you know, when you look at what Harvard is dealing with, and that's Harvard with this huge endowment that none of these schools here can match. But, yeah, I mean, it gave a, it wasn't the biggest flex. It wasn't the biggest, you know, sign of the resistance coming from Ohio schools.
So, yeah. But what do you make of, like, what's the idea behind just signing this letter? Is it just for show, or is it just they don't know what to do, so here's something we're doing?
I think that you have the power you have. I mean, mm-hmm. if you read the letter, what they're saying is, like, we are open to reforms. It's not that we're not going to change anything about how we do business, but there's clearly something coercive coming from the White House. When you look at the list of policy demands they sent to Harvard, there was no rhyme or reason to it. You have to change your anti-Semitism policy. You have to change your dealing with these different kinds of complaints and grounds of sex and race on campus. It was just a list of policy demands from the White House. And I think it raises some real First Amendment concerns. And these are universities, mm-hmm. they're places of research and speech. And I think it was just their way of saying, look, we will not be cowed. We will not be pushed and prodded into adopting. We have academic freedom. It's a statement mm-hmm. of academic freedom.
Joe?
As someone who my kids went to private university, and I have a lot of experience with Ohio Wesleyan, they value diversity. That's part of the allure. I mean, if you go to Ohio Wesleyan, you can go anywhere on campus and find people from other parts of the world. And the value that they bring to that university is great because you learn about different customs and cultures. And for, you know, a student who really wants to have that experience, that's precious. And so, you know, having anything that threatens the ability of a university to do that, especially when it's part of the fabric, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they, as far as anti-discrimination policies, they have these universities that we were talking about, they all have anti-discrimination policies. So if you're a Christian kid and you go on that campus and someone starts making fun of you because of your religious affiliation, that would not be tolerated. So there are anti-discrimination policies, and to have the federal government or any government come in, they feel that it puts at risk one of the very things that they covet the most, which is the diversity of thought and opinion.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about the latest developments with Intel. And Intel's always in the news. And there's also new developments with the state's largest and ongoing political corruption case. That's when the Reporter Roundtable continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us is Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Jake Zuckerman, reporter for Signal Ohio, and Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. I wanted to get an Intel update in. It seems like every month there's a new development with Intel, and it's not always a good thing. Bloomberg News reported last week that Intel plans to lay off 20% of its workforce, and these are in addition to layoffs that were already announced last August. Intel is building a $28 billion chip-making facility here in Central Ohio, and Governor DeWine commented last week saying that he's still feels a strong commitment to Intel. What did you make of his comments?
I mean, he says they've already spent $8 billion. They're not going to walk away. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that chips will be built at that facility. It might not be Intel. They may end up selling it before it actually goes into operation. But the state is pretty bullish on the project.
if you build it, they will come. The chips will come. Is that where we're at right now, Joe?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. It's been pushed off so much, but I think, you know, there has been a lot of money spent, and it could be attractive to another company who might want to come in and do chips. But again, you know, we were talking about uncertainty before, and uncertainty is playing an effect in this situation as well, because, you know, Intel's bottom line, they're really making all these cuts to try to deal with things that are forces that are not entirely in their control. So, and in all the businesses, the business community will tell you right now, I've read many, many stories about how they're trying to make decisions and not really knowing where things are going to land. So I think that's going to play into the timetable for this as well.
And Jake, what do you make of the governor's comments? I mean, he has to say he's still on board. He's been a big proponent of getting Intel here. Yeah.
I mean, what's he going to say? Like, oh, well, the jobs are probably gone, so yeah. Everybody go home. What sticks out to me, though, is if this idea is right, that someone will build chips there, you know, the likely other candidate and one that's been rumored in news reports is TSMC, the Taiwanese semiconductor manufacturing company. I hope I haven't
butchered
that.
Oh, good job. Yeah, yeah.
But, wow, what a thing that would be if all these the state and federal governments turn out their pockets to boost domestic manufacturing of chips, and then a Taiwanese company comes in and builds the chips here. That would really just be an incredible turnabout.
The other, I think just, you know, the economic future is a little uncertain with the trade war, and I think that's kind of putting a chill on, you know, big projects. Likewise, Donald Trump, back in February, he called the CHIPS Act, which is a major piece of funding for this project, he called it a horrible, horrible idea.
He wants Congress to repeal the CHIPS Act. Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's another big looming piece of uncertainty.
All right, well, let's move on to more uncertainty. There are new developments in the House Bill 6 corruption case. Plus, there's a new documentary that's bringing widespread attention to the case by way of the two-part HBO Max documentary called The Dark Money Game. One local journalist figures prominently in that, the Ohio Confidential, that's Laura Bischoff, featured in the documentary. You enjoying your TV fame?
I got recognized like in an alley. Some guy rolled his window down.
And oh, that's not creepy.
I was like, oh, yeah. And he goes, hey, good job on the documentary. I was like, okay, thank you.
It's the most harmless thing that has ever been said in an alley.
Yeah. I know. It was, yeah.
He's like, he's a fan of corruption dramas, and he recognized you. All right. So the latest developments, Laura, are that a Franklin County judge has granted immunity to four former First Energy officials. Do I have that right?
Yes, three former lobbyists and the former senior VP of marketing.
So what does this mean if they're getting immunity? Do we know why?
Well, the Ohio Consumers Council asked, I think they played a role in this, and it has to do with these investigations ongoing by the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio that were put on hold while the feds, you know, did their prosecution stuff. And They're back on now, and they're trying to get testimony from these lobbyists and Dennis Chack, the former marketing guy. And back in March, I think, or maybe earlier, they invoked their First Amendment or Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination, so they wouldn't testify. And so they went to a local judge, Judge Richard Brown. He's new on the bench. He used to be in the Ohio House. He granted an immunity so that they could testify.
Now, it's been 5 years. So what are investigators hoping to learn? I mean, do we have any idea what they can learn from this?
Well, the PUCO has got, I think three or four different investigations going on. One of them has to do with the political and charitable spending leading up to and during the House Bill 6 passage. So that would be really illuminating. When the deferred prosecution agreement came out a year after the arrests, that was where First Energy said, hey, right, we paid these bribes, we did, you know, we were wrong, we did it all by stealth, and they paid a $230 million fine, and they forked over a whole bunch of information to the federal prosecutors. And then they had to, going forward, they had to disclose on their website, like, their political and charitable giving. But it didn't require them to look backward and disclose all their political and charitable giving in the rearview mirror. So the question is, you know, what else was spent on other, were there other people who benefited from the largesse of First Energy's dark money machine?
Can we predict the future? What's going to come out of this? What do you think, Jake?
I think we could talk about the past a lot easier, and we could talk about the future. Yeah. And in the past, the PUCO has been kicking this around for 5 years with a pretty remarkable lack of progress. You know, like, I mean, the ultimate point of these investigations, I think more so than fact-finding, is to penalize First Energy. You know, mm-hmm. they've paid criminal penalties in association with the criminal prosecution, but these are regulators. These are the people who oversee state utilities. I believe they've had to make some nominal repayments to, I wouldn't say nominal, but smaller scale repayments to customers for some of the money that was what used customer money to fund this political scandal that shouldn't have been. But the Consumers Council is asking for, I think, $60 million in penalties from just one of them. So it's really about making First Energy hurt. Some of these guys have already been immunized in the state and federal prosecutions, but that means these prosecutors have gotten to hear from them and hear what they have to say. The Consumers Council, who has been the driving force of these investigations, has not. So I think they have a lot of questions. You know, these were people who were helping move some of the money around and who were brokering the meetings where these sorts of transactions happened. So I think the idea is that from these depositions, now immunized, now free to go on, could come information, and that information could drive up the amount First Energy has to pay the state. Or one option on the table is to take away First Energy's ability to operate in the state of Ohio. That sounds pretty extreme. I don't think that's really going to happen, but that could come out of this and wouldn't seem that crazy for the biggest bribery scandal in state history.
Laura, what has it been like watching the documentary? I have to think you were interviewed for it a while ago, because this has been going on for 5 years. Is it, does it feel like that's, you know, come up anew, like everyone's talking about it again? Or has it never gone away?
Well, it's never gone away. Yeah. I got interviewed almost 2 years ago by Alex Gibney, the filmmaker. And, you know, I kept touching base with them every now and then, like, hey, when's it gonna air?
Mm-hmm.
Finally came out. And, you know, I thought it was just fascinating how they pulled together a lot of footage, visual material, audio material, and the narrative story, and really distilled the story into a 2-hour package, which seems like a lot, 2 hours. But when you consider this is a Ohio-based Fortune 500 company, there's 4.5 million utility customers that were going to be impacted by this, that took down the Speaker of the House, he's in prison, the former chair of the PUCO and a former lobbyist both died by suicide, former Ohio GOP. I mean, they're a $230 million fine paid. It is a massive case. And I think they used it to tell the story of dark money and what kind of bad things can happen from that.
And there's a second part to it where it's talking about how it can play out nationally, like not just the Ohio part. Right?
Yeah, Wealth of the Wicked is the second 2-hour episode. And that takes a look at, it's a little more historical and it's definitely national, about how the anti-abortion forces joined together with a lot of big businesses that wanted less regulation and, you know, worked together to reshape the U.S. Supreme Court and to, you know, take Roe v. Wade down in the Dobbs decision. That was the ultimate goal for the anti-abortion folks. And then the business community has gotten a lot of wins as well.
All right. Ohio Confidential, the dark money game, all of that on Max. Check it out, everyone. Okay. I wanted to move on because in just 8 days, we have a primary election, whether anyone knows that or not. It's a very quiet primary compared to other recent primary elections, but there is a statewide issue on the ballot, issue 2. And I have seen a few vote yes signs in a couple different places near where I live, but that's about it. Joe, can you talk about this issue too? It's a critical issue for cities and counties and townships and villages that rely on $2.5 billion in bond issues to repair roads and bridges.
Yeah, and basically, if the voters vote yes on it for the next 10 years, the state would be allowed to continue to issue bonds to fund those things for local municipalities mainly. You know, it's something that's been going on since 1987. That was when it first came into play. And voters have repeatedly said, yes, we want it to continue. It's issuing bonds, so it doesn't raise taxes. And it goes for public works projects. And I want to make very clear, 110% certain clear, that this does not affect the Brown Stadium funding request that we're hearing so much about. That could not be paid for with issue two funds. That's not what it's about. This is for wastewater. This is for, you know, public works projects, roads, bridges, those kind of things you were just talking about. And
is there fear that there's going to be confusion because the Browns thing is in the news so much and they're both involved the word bonds? Is that the confusion?
Yes, that's the fear, is that people are going to think it's the Browns bonds issue. And that's not. That's part of the budget. And the budget is going on in the backdrop while we're doing this election too. So, you know, that they're hearing about the Browns all the time, and then they see bonds and they're like, oh, I don't want the Browns getting the bonds, and they can vote no on that or whatever. And that's, we want to make very clear that that's not the same thing.
Yeah, I think the issue too, folks are just a smidge nervous about that. You know, the $600 million bond for a new Brown stadium, it that would never be on the ballot because it would fail for sure. People are, you know, voters are not keen on spending that kind of money on public stadiums.
Well, I want to, just for the public good, early voting is underway right now. The hours for in-person voting are 7:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. There is voting this weekend, Saturday 8 to 4, Sunday 1 to 5. And that's the only weekend that had early voting. And there's no early voting on Monday the 5th. The election is Tuesday the 6th. I think I got that all right.
And there's a lot of things on the ballot, too, in local communities, Amy. I mean, you know, you might have a library levy. You might have candidates. I know that Columbus has candidates on the ballot.
There's a city council race, and there's Columbus School Board.
Right. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot on the ballot, and people should really go to you can go to your local Board of Elections website, go to the State Board of Elections website, the League of Women Voters website. There's so many different places you can go, and it will tell you what's on your local ballot, and you can, you know, find out before you go vote.
And one more note.
Yeah.
Be nice to your poll workers. They're your neighbors, and they're having a very long day, and they don't get paid that much.
That's right.
Yes. And, so the election, Tuesday, May 6th, and the issue two, even though it has the word bond in it, has nothing to do with the Cleveland Browns.
Right. Nothing.
All right. Well, this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News and our reporter roundtable. And after the break, we will talk about the Browns Stadium a little bit more, and we'll get into that. And we're also going to talk about qualified immunity. That is when the Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And with us this week is Jake Zuckerman with Signal Ohio, Joe Ingles with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Laura Bischoff with the Columbus Dispatch. Now, I wanted to jump into the Brown Stadium because we mentioned it. It is not issue two, but the Brown Stadium does involve bonds, a proposed $600 million in bonds for the Cleveland Browns to build a dome stadium in a suburb of Cleveland. So where are we at on this project right now? Because recently it's been in the news, and we're waiting for the Senate to make a decision on what they want to do. And they're kind of proposing a compromise between what Governor DeWine wanted and what the House passed. Joe, you want to tell us a little bit about what the Senate
the rumor is that the Senate is doing. I mean, they're just back in session today. They haven't actually done it.
Right. Right. They haven't done anything yet. Governor DeWine, let me back that up. Governor DeWine wanted to develop a fund that would pay for things like the Brown Stadium, but could also pay for things for the arts, could also pay for kids who can't afford pay-to-play fees, that kind of thing. It would be an ongoing fund. It would have been subsidized, or actually the money would have come from out-of-state gambling operators. And that would have been a continuous thing that would just go on, so that you wouldn't have all these requests going to the state at budget time. The House took that out. They didn't like it. They passed this $600 million bond package as part of their budget. So now the Senate's looking at it thinking, okay, now do we keep this or not? And we've been hearing the state leaders saying, well, you know, this is an economic boon to the community. But our Karen Kassler has been working on this, and she has found that there could be documents out there, other documents and budget kind of documents that show otherwise. She's trying to get her hands on them. And, you know, I think that there will be some. The Senate will have to take a critical look at whether this is something that makes economic sense for Ohio. And if they get something too damning, that might be difficult for them to do.
An economics professor, J.C. Bradbury from Kennesaw State University, he's a leading expert on this topic, and he spoke with WOSU's Mike Thompson for our political podcast, Snollygoster, and he noted that economists have studied the issue for decades about promised economic development booms around stadiums, and they hardly ever materialize to the degree that's promised. That's what he's saying. And he was asked about Governor DeWine's proposal to double the sports betting tax, and Professor Bradbury was not a fan.
Stand up and be a man. This is absolutely ridiculous. And what spineless people do we elect that won't stand up to these wealthy owners? And the reason they stand up is that they're in on the grift. They're the ones that get to spend time in the owner's box. They're the ones that get gifted free jerseys. They're part of the upper crust that get to go to these stadium events. What voters need to do is start electing better people rather than these pathetic losers.
He did not hold back. Wow. I know. Wow. Right? I know.
Wow.
So that's in our political podcast, Snollygoster, which tends to be a little more snarky than this show. But yeah, so he's just basically saying that the state doesn't owe the Haslam Sports Group or the Browns anything. What do you make of that kind of comment?
Well, I'd add here that the Haslams are one of the biggest. I think I'm safe saying one of the biggest Republican political donors in the state. They're from a really wealthy family. Their family owns pieces of the Nashville Predators, the Milwaukee Bucks, the Columbus Crew, the Cleveland Browns. You know, they pilot gas stations, and they write huge checks to the Republican Party. So it's more than just, you know, getting tickets. These candidate campaigns are in part underwritten by the Haslams.
And I think, you know, honestly, in the back of everyone's mind is what happened with the Browns moving to Baltimore years ago. I think a lot of people remember that, and when Art Modell picked them up and moved them. And I think that's something that kind of plays in people's minds because, you know, Cleveland has a strong fan base, even though the team kind of stinks a lot of times.
I know
that's an understatement, but you know, hey, maybe, you know, you can always hope. But I think there's a lot of people who remember that, and so, you know, there might be some will to do something to help them, you know, stay. Whether that's a $600 million bond package is another question.
Laura, any predictions on whether the Senate will keep it in or keep the compromise in? Or
I tend to think that they'll do something for the Browns. And maybe it'll be the hybrid approach. Mm-hmm. You know,
we have to wait and see.
We have to, yeah, wait and see. But I don't think that they're going to just leave them high and dry and not give them anything.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens. The Senate is back in session this week, and I'm sure that will come up as a big topic of controversy. I did want to talk about something else that happened last week related to qualified immunity. Attorney General Dave Yost will finally allow a qualified immunity issue to get one step closer to voters. He rejected proposed ballot language about this 8 times before, and then the U.S. Supreme Court weighed in. So this has been a multi-year battle. Can anyone catch us up and first of all, maybe explain what qualified immunity is, because I have had to look it up each time I'm trying to talk about it.
It would allow citizens to sue police officers or other public employees who violate their constitutional rights. Generally speaking, police and public officials, they have immunity from prosecution if they were on the job doing their job. Mm-hmm. And this is this effort to end qualified immunity is super unpopular with police unions and police officers, and apparently Dave Yost, because he has, I think he has told them multiple times that their summary language didn't, you know, meet the requirements.
The problems, he just had issue with the title. I think it was something like protecting Ohioans' constitutional rights, and he deemed that a material misleading statement and rejected their application. That was one of the 9 rejections that Dave Yost filed here.
So after the Supreme Court weighed in and basically told him to stop, told him to stop denying the language, he did. So it's with the ballot board now. Is that where it's at, Joe?
It will be going to the ballot board. Yes.
Well, it's actually, there's one that's through the ballot board. There are 2 of these petitions to abolish qualified immunity. And the reason the litigation continued, even though the ballot board accepted a second one, is the organizer wants to bring another petition here that would in some way address wrongful convictions. There's not a lot of detail, but it's worth drilling into what the courts have said here. Because the courts have looked not just at Dave Yost's actions in this case, but the law that gives the attorney general this power. It says that the attorney general has the power to look at the language, the summary language petitioners are being presented with, and say, is this an accurate summary of what this amendment would actually do? And this is a U.S. District Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals both said, not only is Dave Yost likely violating the First Amendment in just rejecting this over and over, I think they called him like a hyper meticulous editor, he's just quibbling really, but they say that this law is a fundamental First Amendment violation, in that when people are bringing these sorts of ideas, they're petitioning their government and they're speaking. Those are 2 very core First Amendment activities, and here you have an attorney general who they say is really, this law gives them too much leeway to go way beyond the powers of his office into breaking up those First Amendment activities, that petitioning and that criticism. So the courts were looking at striking down this law altogether. So that put a lot of pressure on Dave Yost to just certify the language and not risk losing all his power over all future referendums going forward. Hmm. When we were just talking about SB1, you could see how that is a power Dave Yost would like to keep. So backing down on this made some strategic sense.
So this qualified immunity issue, though, is it do they have to get the ballot, the language approved by the ballot board, and then do they still have to go get signatures? I'm not, this is a very low starting in the process.
Yeah, eventually, 445, around there, 445,000 signatures. It's a lot of signatures.
Okay, so, but they need the language in order for something for people to sign. That's
right,
what they're waiting
for. And that's another hurdle, because we've seen what the ballot board has done with ballot language on some other issues. So the ballot board could very well make the summary, you know, different than what they have at the intent.
The ballot board has approved one of these, just to be clear. One of the qualified immunity petitions that was in December of last year, the ballot board approved, and that is free for people to sign. Now there's this duplicative effort going forward that was really just a product of this litigation that continued almost past its political point.
Okay. So they'll have to sort that out.
Yeah, I hope I've sufficiently confused all the listeners out there.
I'm a little bit confused, but whenever I'm confused, I just say, let's move on. So this is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. With me in the studio is Jake Zuckerman, reporter at Signal Ohio, Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Mental health of children has been a priority of Governor DeWine. He announced last week that starting on July 1st, all 88 counties will have a mobile response and stabilization service program that will be activated by calling 988, the suicide hotline. Joe, less than half the counties in the state have that program now. So how is this going to work with this added part that starts on July 1st?
Well, it'll already be funded out of money, the Ohio RISE program. It'll be funded out of money that already exists. So it's not like it's something new that's going to fund it. But what they are doing is expanding these services to every single county, because if you have a if you have a kid, and this would be 20 and under, actually, that would be affected. But if you have a child that's you know, acting out or having some sort of problem, real catastrophe at that point, in some of these counties, there's no one to call except the police or you know, maybe a social service, but neither of those are actually able to deal with these problems. So by having this in every community, you would have the availability of a mental health professional being dispatched to the situation, to the scene, whether it be at school or home or wherever it is. They would go to that community and take care of the problem. And then the child would get, you know, follow-up care along with that. And basically, it's a way to actually deal with the problem without getting, you know, getting something handed in the police, in the justice system or something like that, because that often makes the situation even worse and doesn't address the real issue.
Well, before we went out of time, Jake, you've been writing about some environmental news. Ohio regulators rejected a permit for the Stark Solar Farm that would have been a 150-megawatt solar farm in Stark County. What did opposition look like for this project? How did it end up getting rejected?
Yeah, the opposition looks like what it looks like in almost cookie-cutter form around the state. Usually it starts with locals who have opposition. The criticisms range. Some people say that solar might deteriorate the value of their home. It'll interfere with the view shed. Some of it gets a little kookier, like this really misinformation that solar will somehow poison the groundwater or be incredibly loud. It's really not loud if you go on one of these fields. But they form a 501c3, one of the nonprofits. That nonprofit hires the same attorney that handles all these cases, and they file opposition at the Ohio Power Siting Board, which is almost a sister to the Public Utilities Commission that we've talked about. And the Ohio Power Siting Board, in cases both before and after a new law that took effect, put a lot of stock into what do the locals think. Now, all power projects in Ohio are sited at the state level, so it almost... It doesn't matter what the locals think. Like, if you're building a gas plant or a coal plant, the state says what goes, not the locals. But just with wind and solar, effectively the locals get veto power. And here the Power Siting Board, as they have with tons of other solar farms around the state, said there's no problem with the technical details, the environmental details, et cetera, of this project. But the locals oppose it, real specifically the local townships and counties oppose it. So therefore, it is not, as the law requires, in the, quote, public interest, convenience, and necessity. And that point, that public interest, is being litigated at the Ohio Supreme Court right now. But for now, the Ohio Power Siting Board is just on a warpath of shutting down these solar farms.
All right. So we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah.
And Laura, we are down to about 2 minutes left, but I wanted you to be able to give us an update. You did an in-depth investigative series on dog attacks. Mother and son, Susan and Adam Withers, highlighted in the series, have gone to jail. And it was quite a lengthy sentence for the fatal attack that killed Joanne Eckelberger. What kind of reaction have you been getting since that sentencing? It was a lengthy sentence.
Yeah, they got a minimum of 14 years on the involuntary manslaughter charge, and then the violations of the dog laws piled on top of that in a consecutive sentence rather than concurrent. So they could end up spending, like, I think a maximum of 19 years, which is you know, quite a long bit in time. I think the Eichelbarger family was pleased with that sentence. They're also suing in civil court as well. And in terms of what's happening at the legislature, there were two bills introduced from two Democrats, Cecil Thomas and Meredith Lawson Rowe. But the victims and their families are not happy with the wording of those bills. And Kevin Miller, who is a Republican from Newark, he is still working on another bill soon to come. So
just, you know, in like 30 seconds or so, what are they not happy with in what the bills say?
Well, they don't.
They want them to have more teeth. Yeah, that's a bad pun.
Intended.
Yeah, that's a horrible pun.
The essentially it doesn't go far enough. Mm-hmm. It's not comprehensive, just small tweaks to the law rather than a thorough look.
Mm. All right. Well, we're down to less than a minute left. What are we going to be covering this week? Just waiting to see the Senate back in session. What are they going to be doing?
Yeah, I think everyone's got their eyes on the budget to see what's coming out with that and where they go with the Brown Stadium and where they go with all these school funding issues. Yeah,
yeah, we made it a whole hour and we didn't really talk about school funding.
Yeah, I'm shocked.
Can we do Medicaid? Do we have time for Medicaid?
We do not have time for Medicaid because Medicaid will take a whole hour. So we're going to leave it there. I want to say thank you to our reporters. This has been the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. Thank you, Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
And Jake Zuckerman, the newest reporter at Signal Ohio. Thanks, Jake.
Thank you for having me on.
And Joe Ingles, reporter at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.